Hi, dear listeners. I just want to remind you that about a month and a half ago, Undisclosed began its Patreon page. We now have our second episode up. It's a bonus episode where Susan Cullen and I talk about the new season of Serial. And in our first episode, we covered the case of Curtis Flowers, the State versus Curtis Flowers, which was featured in the second season of In the Dark, an award-winning podcast. So check out these episodes. Sign up to become a patron today of Undisclosed in order to support our work and also to get some great content. And every month, at least, if not more frequently, we'll be dropping bonus episodes and doing maybe some updates on other cases that we have been covering the last few years. To sign up and become a patron for as little as $5 a month, all you have to do is go to www.patreon, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Once again, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Thank you so much for your support and for listening.
The first time I learned that C's drug money might have played a role in Dennis Perry's conviction was when I came across an article about it in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It had been published in January of 2000, just a few days after Dennis Perry was arrested for the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. The headline read, "Camden Payoff: Confiscated Drug Money May Solve 1985 Murder." And the article went on to describe how Sheriff Bill Smith of Camden County had used money seized from drug traffickers in order to hire a full-time investigator for the Swain case. Later, when I was talking to Deputy Dale Bundy, I'd asked him about the article. Not for any real reason. Pretty much just because I was curious about it.
I read I think it was AJC article on it, about how they got the money for funding. There's something about like the $40,000 they got in a drug seizure.
No.
Really?
No. I was paid under a grant. I was paid under a federal grant.
Oh. So there is an article somewhere that talks about...
If you read Susan Green's article from Las Vegas...
Possibly. Is it...
I would take that article with a grain of salt. Much of what Susan Green was told, she was told by Joe Gregory. I would take anything that was in that article with a grain of salt because of the source that it came from.
I was pretty sure that the article I'd read hadn't been from Las Vegas, but I wasn't going to argue the point. The next time I talked to Dale Bundy, though, he was the one who brought the subject up again.
Somebody asked me yesterday how I was paid. Wasn't I paid out of seized assets? No, ma'am. Again, I found the name. I believe it's still called the COPS grant, COPS grant. But you cannot pay anyone a salary out of seized assets. It is for equipment and training only. So I was not paid out of seized assets. I don't know where you got that information, but it is absolutely not true.
The night before, though, after talking to Bundy the first time, I pulled up the article I'd remembered reading, just to make sure I hadn't imagined it. I'd still had it pulled up on my computer, so I showed it to Bundy.
This is what the article I saw. It says, "Confiscated drug money may solve 85 murders."
I don't know who wrote that.
Bill Smith actually is the quote. So I figured he says, because his deputies patrol part of the I-95, they routinely seize large amounts of cash from drug dealers. Some of that returned to Smith's office. 18 months ago, he got clearance to spend about $40,000 recovered drug money.
Okay. He may have.
Okay.
You know, I don't. But I was told I was working under the COPS grant.
Okay.
Didn't make any difference to me. I got a paycheck every 2 weeks. That's, you know, I didn't really care where it came from.
No, I was just curious.
But it was my understanding, and it still is true, that seized assets. Now, he may have gotten approval from the Attorney General's office.
Okay.
That's who that would have had to come from. But, you know, that's news to me.
Okay.
So,
no, I was only wondering because I saw the quotes were from him. So
again, I wasn't trying to mislead you or anything, but that was my thought that I was working under a grant because I was told that, you know, the grant's expiring and, you know, we're hoping they renew it. If not, we don't know what we're going to do with you. And I suppose, you know, if I got to go out the door, I go.
Dale Bundy is not the kind of guy who sounds flustered or defensive very often. I'd asked him plenty of questions about Dennis Perry's case that I'd have thought would be much more challenging or difficult to answer, and they hadn't given him pause at all. But this question about how Bundy had been paid was pretty much the only time that Bundy had reacted as if I'd caught him off guard at something. And I hadn't even been trying to. Anyway, that's pretty much the entire story of why, earlier this year, I developed a sudden interest in civil asset forfeiture laws. And this episode is a story about what I found as a result.
welcome to Undisclosed. This is our 15th episode in the State versus Dennis Perry. I'm Colin Miller, an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Robbie is out of town this week, so I'm joined by my co-host Susan Simpson.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
On the same day that I talked to Dale Bundy about it, the issue of how seized drug money got used in Camden County came up for a second time. I was down in Woodbine with Claire Gilbert and the GIP interns, and we got out to dinner. We started talking to our waitress, and when she found out why we were down there in Camden County, she told us that we needed to go to YouTube and look up a video called Camden County Revenue Wars. That evening, we tried to find the video, but had some difficulty. None of the Google results we got seemed particularly promising. Finally, after playing around with a few search terms, we came across a YouTube video that someone had filmed while driving around Camden County, and it primarily featured shots of patrol cars from the Camden County Sheriff's Department. That's when we realized the name of the video that the waitress told us to watch had not been Camden County Revenue Wars.
There they are. Camden County Revenue Wars.
The guy behind the camera is named Jeff Gray. He refers to himself as a citizen journalist, and through his work with the group Photography is Not a Crime, he documents examples of alleged government misconduct and posts those videos online. A lot of his work is done down in Florida, but for this video, he'd made a trip up to Camden County. He was there to investigate the asset seizure practices of the sheriff's office.
These guys right here will be glad to seize your property, ruin your life, take everything you got. Hey, how's it going?
Why are you filming me?
A sheriff's deputy pulls up next to Jeff Gray and begins questioning him about what he's doing. It's actually the second time in this brief video that Gray has been stopped and questioned by sheriff's deputies. This time, the deputy doesn't hide his irritation.
I have no idea if somebody following me with a camera. That don't look right.
Okay, well, I'm looking at it. I'm a journalist.
Because you following the officers and doing this, this ain't legal.
Yeah, it is.
It is?
Yeah.
Well, get in the car with me. I'll tell you anything you
want to
know.
I'd rather not get in the car.
Exactly.
Because
you're not doing something real. Sneaky.
You guys are the ones that are sneaky.
I-95 is a U.S. interstate highway that begins in Miami and runs up the entire length of the eastern seaboard until it crosses the border into Canada and stops being a U.S. highway. Construction on I-95 began in the mid-1950s under President Eisenhower. Last month marked a big milestone in I-95's history, when the highway was, after 60 years, finally completed. The gap in I-95 at the New Jersey-Pennsylvania border was finally completed, and now you can drive from Florida to Maine without ever getting off I-95. In all, the interstate is nearly 2,000 miles long. 26 of those miles run through Camden County, Georgia. And the reason Jeff Gray was in Camden County filming patrol cars has to do with a particular phenomenon you can observe while driving along that stretch of the highway.
On Interstate 95 in Camden County, Georgia. Now notice how they always have their butts to the northbound traffic. I'm traveling northbound. And they're always facing southbound. Always facing southbound. Because southbound is the money side of the road. There's three of them sitting there.
In the video, just like Jeff Gray describes, you can see a series of patrol cars that have stationed themselves in the median of I-95, and all of them had their butts to the north and their noses to the south. What Jeff Gray is suggesting in his video is that there's a financial reason for why the patrol cars arrange themselves in this southerly fashion along the interstate, Because see, I-95 also has a nickname it goes by, Cocaine Lane. I-95 is a major artery for traffickers who smuggle drugs into the U.S. through ports in Florida, and who then distribute those drugs elsewhere in the U.S., up and out of Florida. That makes the northbound lanes of I-95 the drug side of the highway. But this northbound trip is only half of the drug trafficking life cycle. Once those drugs have been moved up north, they're sold off to buyers, and for obvious reasons, most of these purchases are going to be in cash. And all that cash has to make the same journey all again, only this time in reverse, back down to Florida on the other side of I-95. And that's why, according to Jeff Gray, all those patrol cars were pointed south, because that's where the money would be found.
It was an interesting theory anyway. Jeff Gray seemed sincere, but his video admittedly had something of a breathlessly conspiratorial vibe to it, so I had some doubts. Sure, a lot of patrol cars in Camden County did seem to have a noticeably southern tilt, but was that really evidence of some kind of money-making scheme, like he suggested?
So that's not a conspiracy theory.
That's Dan Albin. He's an attorney with the Institute for Justice, a nonprofit law firm that has been at the forefront of litigating against the seizure of private property by the police, even in cases where no crime has been committed by its owner.
It's called civil forfeiture or civil asset forfeiture, where the government can seize and permanently keep someone's property without ever charging them with a crime. And we think that's a tremendous violation of not only due process, but also the right to have and hold property.
When I asked him about this theory about why all the patrol cars in Camden County were usually pointed southbound, I think I'd have expected him to tell me, no, don't be silly, that's not what's going on here.
I wish you had asked me to guess which direction they were headed, because I think I would have gotten it right. Generally, the way law enforcement views drug trafficking corridors in terms of highways is anything north-south, the drugs are headed to the north, the cash is headed to the south.
This doesn't always hold true. The direction that the patrol cars need to face can change based on specific place where they are and the highways. But when it comes to I-95 and that stretch that runs up across the Florida-Georgia border and through Camden County, southbound is definitely the money side. And for highways that run east to west, there's a similar pattern at work. The general rule is drugs go east and north towards the more heavily populated parts of the U.S. And the money goes the other way, towards the southern border and the west coast, where the drugs came in.
But as an example of this, a news channel in Nashville did an investigation on I-40 just east of Nashville and found that a drug task force there spent 90% of their time set up on the side of the road where they expected the cash to be going, the westbound direction, and only 10% of the time on the side of the freeway where they would expect the drugs to be going, the eastbound direction.
If you're wondering how it is that the government can take your property without ever proving you committed a crime, well, you can blame pirates for that, at least a little bit.
Originally, the law came from Admiralty law. This dates back to the age of pirates and smugglers. And the idea was when, you know, we're talking about in the 1700s, basically, the very founding of the country, if someone was smuggling goods into a port or was a pirate and their ship was captured, that person might not actually be with the ship.
In the United States today, the pirates have largely gone extinct. But 35 years ago, the civil forfeiture laws were revived. In 1984, Congress passed the Comprehensive Crime Control Act, which authorized a more expansive use of civil forfeiture as a remedy when law enforcement agencies encountered suspected narcotics traffickers.
And so they just converted these sort of old admiralty laws into modern forfeiture laws, and suddenly you have forfeiture laws authorizing people to, you know, just pull over someone driving down the highway because of a real or imagined, minor traffic offense, such as, you know, not turning off your turn blinker or not signaling a lane change or, you know, supposedly straying out of your lane, and searching the car, seizing the cash, and keeping the cash even when no drugs or anything else illegal is found, just simply based on the suspicion that the cash must be involved in drug trafficking of some sort, because why would you have cash and be traveling on an interstate highway?
If a cop really wants to make a traffic stop, they can find a way. Whatever it is, the car is stopped, the officers convince the person they've pulled over to agree to a search, and while looking around, they find some cash in the person's car. That's when the civil asset forfeiture process begins.
So they get a car, they pull it over, they find no drugs, but they find, I don't know, $20,000 and change and cash in some luggage or something.
Right.
What happens next?
So at that point, they seize the cash, and they usually do it on the suspicion that the cash is drug proceeds of some sort, or that it's going to be used for a drug buy. Drug proceeds is the more common assumption, but sometimes they'll say it's being used for a drug buy.
But and what do they need to be able, before they can do that?
To seize, all they need is probable cause. So seizure is relatively simple, and that's true in just about every state and under federal law. And our issue with civil forfeiture is not the standard for seizure. It is awfully loose, and there probably could be better standards. But in the heat of the moment, you know, an officer has discretion, as long as there is probable cause, to seize things that he thinks are involved in some sort of illegal activity, because it might be able to stop some criminal plot or something, and with a little further investigation, maybe all of that would kind of unravel. The problem with civil forfeiture is what happens next. Usually at the side of the road, the person's given a property receipt, and usually they're sent on their way without any criminal charges, and often officers don't even write them up for whatever the traffic violation is that they were pulled over for.
At this point, it doesn't take much for the government to successfully become the new owner of your property.
The standard to win under Georgia state law, the standard for the government to win and keep someone's property permanently, is just a preponderance of the evidence, which just means more likely than not. So a preponderance of the evidence basically means like 51% likely. That's a lot lower than the standard that people are familiar with from a criminal case, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is that's just a very low standard, because all you have to do if you're the prosecutor there is you get two or three of the officers who are at the traffic stop to go up on the stand, and they'll say, well, in my experience as a law enforcement officer for the past 25 years, I've noticed the following things that are very common of drug dealers, and they'll list off several things. You know, you're driving on the interstate, you're headed between two, you know, drug dealing locations, which is pretty much any city in the country. You know, they're driving a rental car without a state plates. They're driving too fast, too slow, exactly the speed limit. The person was nervous when he was pulled over. The person gave inconsistent answers to questions, because once we asked him where he was going, he said Maryland, and the another time we asked him where he was going, he said Baltimore.
Now, the problem is there are a lot of non-criminal reasons that someone might be driving with cash in their car. WABE, Atlanta Public Radio, reported on a case from 2012. Alda Gentile had driven with her family from New York to Florida to hunt for a vacation home. They didn't find any condos they liked, though, and so they headed back to New York. Alda Gentile still had the $1,100 in cash she'd brought with her as a possible down payment.
This is when the nightmare started, Carl. We were singing Itsy Bitsy Spidey to the baby, and suddenly we see sirens came out of nowhere.
Police stopped them across the Florida border in Camden County, Georgia, allegedly for speeding. She says for hours, officers made them sit by the side of the road while they questioned why she had the money and asked if she was a drug dealer. They eventually seized her cash, even though they didn't find any drugs in the car. She was never charged with a crime.
I was so baffled at the whole thing. And I remember thinking that you guys are not police officers. You're just pirates with badges. That's what you remind me of right now.
Alda Gentile's story is unusual. She went to court to fight the seizure, and she got her money back, minus attorney's fees. But her story is the exception. If your property has been seized by the government, then yes, theoretically you can go to trial and try to get it back. But if your property has been seized and the government is seeking civil forfeiture, then statistically, it's unlikely you'll ever have your day in court.
No, actually the vast majority of the time, and this is sort of one of the dirty little secrets of civil forfeiture, something like 80 to 90% of the time, it's a default. The person, I mean, we're talking about people, for one thing, who are often from out of state, have a difficult time coming back to contest the forfeiture, have a difficult time contacting attorneys in the state, or they couldn't afford to hire an attorney, which is a very common reason. Civil forfeiture laws are very complex. It's incredibly difficult to fight them yourself. And the vast majority of people can't afford to hire an attorney, because the levels of cash seized are often actually fairly low.
It's usually thousands, though?
It's often in the thousands, yeah. I mean, in some places, I mean, in Philadelphia, they were seizing, you know, less than $100 from some people on the street.
After the police seize your property, they then transfer it to a prosecutor who initiates the legal proceedings.
There is a procedure called equitable sharing, wherein you can partner with the feds if you're a local or state law enforcement agency. Let them kind of take over the heavy lifting once you've done the seizure. And if successful, you'll get back 80% of the proceeds, and the feds keep 20%.
The heavy lifting that Dan Albin referenced is all the legal work needed to finalize and close out the seizure. State governments have their own equitable sharing programs to where instead of the feds handling the back ends, the state does.
State law enforcement officers often prefer to pursue a federal forfeiture because the federal standards are lower. As it happens, the very low federal standards are nearly identical to Georgia's very low standards, so there isn't a particular advantage in Georgia to doing this.
In Georgia, either way you go, it's a win-win. The local agency seizes the money, ships it off to a prosecutor under federal and or state equitable sharing program, and the lawyers take care of the rest. They then keep, say, 20% for themselves, depending on the agreement, and ship 80% back to law enforcement agencies that collected in the first place.
And all of that money was available only to be spent by law enforcement agencies. So it created this really perverse profit incentive for law enforcement agencies to focus their efforts on getting cash, sometimes even at the expense of actually, you know, seizing drugs or other illegal contraband, because if they seize that stuff and they're honest, they just have to destroy it. But if they seize the cash, they can use it for all sorts of things.
To give me an idea of just how absurd and disturbing these cases can be, Dan Albin told me about a case that the Institute for Justice had worked on a couple years ago, involving the Cloquet Music Team. The Cloquet Music Team is a band from Myanmar, and they were in the U.S. on a charity tour to raise money for an orphanage. The band held concerts across the United States, mostly at churches, where they'd raise money from ticket sales and donations. And then, one day, the band's manager tried to drive through Muskogee, Oklahoma.
The case involving AWA, the band manager for this band from Burma, he actually was charged with a felony possession of drug proceeds. He had $53,000 in his car. He was pulled over because he had a supposedly broken taillight that fixed itself. And he had all this money because he was the band's manager, and so he had all the money they had raised, and so he had all these envelopes labeled like Tulsa and, you know, all the different names of all the towns they had been to on their tour.
AWA tried to explain to the officers that this cash, tucked away into carefully labeled envelopes, was money that had been raised by the band while on the charity tour.
He put the officers on the phone with the band to confirm, like, yes, this is really what I'm doing. I'm on this charitable tour with this band from Burma. We raised all this money, and we're going to take it back to give to this orphanage, and we're going to take it back to give to this college, this nonprofit college in Burma. And the officers couldn't really understand the band leader, the actual his name is Marvelous, from Burma. His English is okay. I mean, good enough that, you know, he and I can converse okay, but I can totally see how over a cell phone, in a very confusing situation, when officers are suddenly asking you a bunch of questions, why there could be difficulties. And just based on that, the police report basically says there was difficulty in communication. We plan to file charges.
Dan Albin showed me the envelopes that AWA had with him that day.
Here are a bunch of the orphanage envelopes. And you can see they've been torn open, and they were torn open by Muskogee County Sheriff's deputies. And these were all from, you'll see written on them.
I mean, yes, they're not all in English, but the top says, like, the Hostulai Orphanage IDP Learning Center.
Yeah, and it has their address, it has their phone number, it has their email address. Yeah, most of this language on it is actually Karen, because these folks are Karen refugees.
It was kind of shocking to see the proof laid out like that, to see how inexcusable the seizure had been. I just kept picturing the Muskogee deputies pulling over a car with out-of-state tags, searching the car, seeing these envelopes, and then deciding, yeah, this is money that we can take and keep for ourselves.
I'll just show you some of the rest of
this. This isn't even like a question, though. Like, literally, officers grabbed these things
Yes. And
knew they were taking money from orphans.
Yes, you had to, because it says on the front, at the top of the page, Sathulay Orphanage IDP Learning Center, and it even has their emblem in color.
Luckily for AWA and the Cloquet Music Team, the Institute for Justice got involved.
So yeah, he was facing felony charges, and the day that we got involved in the case and got a front page story in the Washington Post, He actually had a hearing in his criminal case. We didn't represent him criminally, but we worked with his criminal defense attorney. And the judge denied that morning the motion to have a hearing on probable cause. Just said, nope, you're going to trial. And so as of, you know, 9 a.m. that morning, he was headed to trial in July. And by 3:30 that afternoon, we got a call from the Muskogee County DA's office saying, oh, yeah, we've decided to drop all charges, return all the money, and we need an address to send the check to. And that shows you sort of the flimsy house of cards this is all built on.
It doesn't always end that way, though. If the Cloquet music team hadn't been able to get an attorney, hadn't gotten connected with the Institute of Justice, who was able to publicize the case and get the money returned, then, well, the Muskogee County Sheriff's Office might have been $40,000 richer after the seizure was finalized and they received their share of the proceeds. Those deputies could have bought themselves a shiny new patrol car, courtesy of some orphans in Myanmar. Because with civil forfeiture, if a motorist has been found driving around with cash, that becomes effectively presumptive evidence of a crime. The government needs only to say, Your Honor, the officers stopped a car, they found cash in it, and from experience, that's how criminals move money. And the burden is then on the person whose property was taken to prove that their property was not crime-related.
That is exactly the problem with civil forfeiture. It flips the burden of proof on its head. And so what everyone thinks about due process and the criminal justice system is exactly the opposite. It's sort of the Alice in Wonderland of civil forfeiture. And it is impossible to prove a negative. I mean, how do you prove a negative? How do I prove that this envelope that says $200 St. Paul is from a donation from a Karen parishioner in St. Paul and not some drug deal?
The reason all this happens, the reason that we have police officers sitting on the money side of the highway and taking money from orphans, is because of what happens next after the seizure is completed. That's when the law enforcement agency gets to figure out how it's going to spend all this free money. Working out feels great, but then there's everything else, like packing a gym bag, finding time to go and still eat lunch, and then go back to work afterwards and trying to shower and all that. And it's hard. It's not just going to the gym, it's going to the gym plus working it into your day. Something's gotta give. That thing's probably gonna be the gym. But Body Boss can help. Now, with Body Boss, you can unlock your dream body with this great 12-week program at home in just 24 minutes a day, 3 days a week. So you can do this. Less than 90 minutes a week, no equipment, no subscription. Just you and Body Boss. And no trying to find time in the workday to go work out, because that sucks. Plus, with the pro coaches and a free Facebook group of supportive kick-ass women like you, you're never alone. So try Body Boss with this special offer just for our listeners and get 25% off the fitness guide at bodyboss.com/undisclosed. And order now and you'll get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. This is their best deal ever. Get Body Boss for 25% off at bodyboss.com/undisclosed. 12 weeks from now, after starting Body Boss, you'll thank yourself for starting now. That's bodyboss.com/undisclosed.
In 2008, when NPR did a four-part series on civil forfeiture abuses, the series finale was dedicated to the abuses going on in Camden County.
NPR's John Burnett has our final report on dirty money.
Camden County, Georgia is famous for Cumberland Island National Seashore, the Kings Bay Submarine Base, the historic town of St. Mary's, and Sheriff Bill Smith. The tanned, white-haired lawman is now running for his seventh term.
During Sheriff Bill Smith's time in office, the Camden County Sheriff's Office was a civil forfeiture powerhouse. Due to lax record keeping, total amounts are unknown, but can be counted in tens of millions of dollars.
Over the past decade and a half, his highway interdiction team has grabbed more than $20 million from drug money couriers.
I'd say Camden County has probably been one of the most successful agencies on the eastern seaboard in seizing money belonging to the drug dealers.
Using highways to generate revenue for local government agencies is something of a tradition in Camden County. Bill Smith didn't invent the practice, he just tried to perfect it. But years before he took office, and before civil forfeiture laws had been enacted, Woodbine had been using a notorious speed trap. In fact, in 1972, the mayor of Woodbine was forced to acknowledge that most of the town's operating revenue came not from taxes or licensing fees in its citizens, but from traffic fines generated by a speed trap the town operated in US 17. The speed trap was only shut down when the state of Georgia revoked Woodbine's authority to arrest motorists.
Dan Albin told me that this was actually a pretty common story. Towns that were once known for their speed traps often became towns that were known for their extensive highway interdiction efforts. The reason, of course, is pretty simple. Doing so results in millions of dollars that law enforcement agencies can more or less use however they see fit.
Theoretically, there are limitations on what this money can be spent on. As a practical matter, there's very little oversight. You're not supposed to, for instance, spend the money on extravagant expenses. That's actually a term from the DOJ guidelines.
I asked Dan Albin about some of the examples I'd seen from Camden County to see where they fell on this extravagant scale.
It's unclear what the limitations are on extravagant.
So what about a $250,000 donation to a college for a scholarship in your name?
That sounds absolutely outrageous, but that sounds very much like examples of forfeiture abuse that I've heard of.
In 2002, Bill Smith had donated $250,000 to the Citadel, where he'd gone to college, to establish a scholarship fund there. He didn't do this from his own money, of course. He made this donation out of the county's seized asset accounts. He also set up at least six other scholarships at other schools. Typically, this would not be considered an allowable use for seized assets. But when I asked Sheriff Bill Smith about it, he told me that he'd sought and received permission to do this from Attorney General Janet Reno.
When we were seizing all this money, and I think we seized around $27 million from the cartel out of South America and what have you off the interstate, what I did is I went to the Attorney General. I had to go like four or five times before I finally got it approved. But none of the other agencies in the country were allowed to use money to educate the young individuals who are working in law enforcement.
Bill Smith is proud of the scholarships that he set up. And he's aware he's gotten criticism for how generous the scholarships to the Citadel have been in particular. But I don't get the sense that he has any real regrets about it.
I think it brought a lot to law enforcement because of the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. I went down to Miami and talked to her, but she approved it, and we were able to use a lot of money, set up scholarships, and I caught hell. I graduated in the Citadel in Charleston, and I said, you know, the Citadel in Charleston would be a fine school to set up these scholarships, and I did.
As for the special permission that was supposedly granted to Camden County by Attorney General Janet Reno, well, maybe it happened. I don't know. But I'll at least note that, at least so far, I haven't been able to turn up anything to document that that kind of permission was given here. And special permission from Janet Reno aside, not all the expenditures were questionable. Some of what Bill Smith used the civil forfeiture money for was exactly the sort of things it's supposed to be used for. Purchases at a place called Larry's Police Supply Depot, a line item for tasers, a new cage for Camden County's bomb dog, underwater metal detectors, stuff like that. These kind of expenditures, though, were in the decisive minority. Most disbursements were for things that had much less obvious of a relationship to law enforcement purposes. Things like the $8,500 spent buying jerseys for the Camden County High School football team, or the $20,000 on school playground equipment. The $2,000 to the Camden County High School Theater Program, or the $5,000 to the Camden County Wrestling Club, or the $10,000 to something called the Special Commissary Account. Not to mention the endless expenses for charity golf tournaments, donations to the International Society of Coroners and Medical Examiners, to the United Negro College Fund, to the Cumberland Christian School, money given to improve camp facilities for the Boy Scouts, money to buy equipment for the cheerleading team, on and on it went.
That's sort of classic political log rolling what I might call just flat out bribery of the public. I mean, yeah, you take funds that are supposed to be spent in the public for the public good, and you spend them in ways that they're clearly identified with you. You know, $250,000 for a scholarship named after you or something. And, you know, it's clearly part of a reelection effort. It's an improper spending of public funds. And unfortunately, it's very effective. People remember these sorts of things. People remember, oh yeah, he's the guy who gave, you know, $10,000 to our Boy Scout troop.
Dan Albin has seen a lot when it comes to how law enforcement agencies have used civil forfeiture funds. But Camden County had at least a few of its own that were new to him.
I've heard of money being spent on tuition for law enforcement officers.
Their families.
I haven't heard of that specifically, but that seems just as, if not more, abusive than spending it on the law enforcement officers themselves.
This wasn't an uncommon expenditure. And then there were other expenses that were just, well, extravagant.
In Camden County, there's also been, both a sports car and I believe some sort of boat, speedboat, or I'm not quite sure what it was.
Dan Albin was right. There had been a sports car bought with the seized assets fund in Camden County. It was a $78,000 Dodge Viper, and the sheriff's office said they needed it for their DARE program. The seized assets fund also paid for a new sound system for the Viper, not to mention upholstery, a new alarm system, and a new paint job. All told, the Camden County DARE car cost $93,000. Even on NPR, during an interview for a story about how Sheriff Smith's abuses of the asset forfeiture program, the sheriff's office couldn't resist bragging about it.
And the purchases got more exotic. There was the $90,000 Dodge Viper for the sheriff's DARE anti-drug program. Lieutenant William Terrell opens a trailer parked in the lot behind the substation to reveal the gleaming, low-slung sports car.
The year we took this out to Las Vegas for the National DARE Convention, it was the number one DARE car in the country.
Dan Albin was right about there being a boat, too. Actually, it was boats, plural, 11 of them, plus the jet skis. The fleet was referred to as the Camden County Navy, and for the most part, it was all done in the open, because the sheriff's office was proud of its drug money haul. Dennis Perry's uncle, Ed Wilson, recalled how the sheriff's office would advertise where it all came from.
It's amazing the things that they do with the seized drug money here.
Like what?
Well, they got a big, I don't know if they've still got it. They had a big yacht. And right on the back of it, it says, this vessel purchased with confiscated drug money in Camden County.
A few questions. So wait, why do they need a yacht?
It beats me. And the only reason I know that, because I was going to Jacksonville one time, and there's a big truck pulling a big boat in front of me, and it said on the back of it, this vessel purchased with confiscated drug money, Camden County Sheriff's Office, or something like that. And I thought, well, that's amazing. And I rode by it, and it's 35, 38 feet long, nice, you know. And who's driving the truck? Bill Smith. Really? Must be nice going into Florida.
RX Bar wants to build things the right way. RX Bar believes in the power of transparency and lets the core ingredients do all the talking with all them listed in the front of the packaging. You'd likely recognize RX Bar at the shelf. They're the ones who have the egg whites for protein, dates to bind, nuts for texture, and other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spices like sea salt or cinnamon. The adult bars come in 14 delicious flavors like peanut butter chocolate, chocolate sea salt, blueberry, mixed berry, and coconut chocolate. And RX Bar has a kids line as well. The texture is softer and the nuts are chopped up into smaller pieces. Both the adult and the kids bars are gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and they have no artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. RX Bars are perfect for parents for pre- and post-workout, breakfast on the go, snack at the office, or to keep in your car. And they're perfect for kids for a delicious lunchbox add-in, an after-school snack, or being thrown in a sports bag for a before or after practice snack. Now, I'm a big fan of foods without a lot of fillers or artificial sweeteners, so I was thrilled when RX Bar decided to sponsor our show. Now, every afternoon, before my typical 3 o'clock nosedive in energy, I have one of RX Bar's delicious chocolate sea salt bars, and it keeps me going for the rest of the day. And now, RX Bar is offering you an exclusive pack of 6 adult bars and 4 kids bars, so the whole family is able to enjoy. For 25% off your first offer, visit rxbar.com/undisclosed and enter the promo code undisclosed at checkout. Valid in the U.S. only.
In addition to Dodge Vipers and yachts, here's one more thing that was paid for by the Seized Assets Fund. Dale Bundy's salary when he was rehired to take on the Swain case. I know that because Bill Smith himself confirmed it for me.
One of the deputies, it's a long story. We were at the time involved in interdiction of drug money from the interstate, and we had quite a bit of money that we had seized. And I don't know, we got to talking about it, myself and Charlie Easterling, who is now dead, and other employees of the department, and we decided that maybe we should hire an investigator to come in and do nothing but just work that case. We decided on an individual, very smart investigator by the name of Dale Bundy. And Dale came in and investigated exclusively that case.
Without knowing all the details of how Bundy's employment situation was set up, I can't say for sure, but it's entirely possible that what Bill Smith is describing here was in full compliance with all the applicable regulations. As a general matter, yeah, seized assets aren't supposed to be used for salaries. Bundy was right about that. But there are some exceptions built in, and based on how Sheriff Smith has described the way Bundy was hired and how his salary got paid out, it was probably fine, I think. I'm not sure it actually broke any rules. Which makes it really weird to me that Dale Bundy is so insistent on disagreeing with Bill Smith about how and why he was hired to come work on the Swain case. And why he's still sticking with the story about some kind of grant being received.
There was myself and two other people that were working under this grant. I forget the name of the grant, but it was a grant they gave to hire extra people with, and I filled one of those slots.
What did the other two people come on to work on, like cold cases or something?
I have not gotten the foggiest idea.
But it was like task-based, kind of? Like, you came on with a, like, I'm guessing Bill Smith set the agenda, like, here's the case you're going to work on, or did you have other cases you were given, or?
Yeah, I worked other cases.
Part of me has to think that Dale Bundy knows this story isn't the entire truth, because the use of the seized asset fund to hire Dale Bundy to work in the Swain case, that wasn't a secret. It was well known enough to be a topic of political humor in Camden County. I don't know exactly where it came from, but in the DA's file, there's a copy of this political cartoon that must have been published in some local paper. There's a handwritten date on it, January 19th, 2000, just 6 days after Dennis Perry's arrest. The cartoon depicts Sheriff Smith and Dale Bundy out in a fishing boat, and it's captioned, "Catch of the Day." Dale Bundy is reeling in a huge, confused-looking fish. You can tell it's confused because this fish has eyebrows, and they're raised up in a baffled sort of expression. Plus, in case the eyebrows don't make it clear enough, there's also a question mark over the fish's forehead. The fish is a metaphor for Dennis Perry. And we can tell that because this fish is helpfully labeled with, quote, "suspect in a 15-year-old murder case." Anyway, in this cartoon, Bundy is reeling in this poor, confused fish, and Sheriff Bill Smith is there reaching out with a net, just about to scoop it up and bring it onto the boat. And because this is a political cartoon, the boat too is a metaphor. The boat's name is written across its side. Quote, "seize drug money." I wonder what the artist who drew this cartoon knew about the Swain investigation and the use of seized drug money to solve it. The artist couldn't have known the whole story, though, because at that point, in January of 2000, the boat metaphor from this cartoon hadn't fully played out yet. In arresting Dennis Perry, Dale Bundy and Bill Smith had successfully hooked their fish, but they still had to get it into the boat, which, in the context of the boat metaphor, would mean convicting Dennis Perry of the double homicide. And, it turned out, seized drug money would keep Dale Bundy and Bill Smith afloat through all of it.
The accusation that Sheriff Bill Smith used forfeiture funds at his whim is at the heart of wider criticism that there are scant controls over how seized drug money is used. Again, Commissioner Steve Berry.
And that's really the root of the problem. You have one man in total control of $25 to $30 million with no checks and balances. Now, you can imagine what would happen at that point. I mean, the old adage of, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely is proven perfectly there.
At the risk of stating the obvious, money talks. Money can influence how law enforcement agencies patrol their highways, and it can influence how and when witnesses come forward. Which is why the Civil Forfeiture Fund was not the only money in this case that I was interested in learning more about. There was also the matter of the reward money. Even before I learned about Prime Suspect and the $25,000 that it offered, I'd heard lots of talk around Camden County about who in Dennis Perry's case might have been compensated for the testimony. But it was all just that, talk. Most of it, I tuned out. But when that talk came from former Deputy Butch Kennedy, I paid more attention. Although the talk he'd heard didn't really make much sense to me.
Rozier ended up getting some of the reward. Carol, mother, and him split that. My information is, I don't know that. I honestly don't.
Rozier is Corky Rozier. And if you're wondering why he would have gotten paid an award in this case, don't worry, you haven't missed anything. I don't get it either. But Corky Rozier was a neighbor of Dennis Perry's grandparents who had once called in a tip about him to Unsolved Mysteries. He was the one who suggested that Dennis Perry had killed Harold Swain after Harold had discovered a secret marijuana field, and Dennis was somehow helping to cultivate it.
What was this reward?
Pardon?
What was the reward?
I'd be afraid to even speculate. I don't remember.
But you heard that the Rozier's and Jane Beaver split it?
Jane Beaver, yeah. Yep, and I know Rozier got some.
But the reason it made no sense to me that Corky Rozier could have gotten this reward is that Corky Rozier didn't testify at Dennis Perry's trial. And that part probably isn't surprising, because when Corky Rozier and his wife Glenda were interviewed by Dale Bundy in December of 1998, they told a story that was radically different from the story Jane Beaver had told. Here's how GBI agent Ron Rhodes summarized the interview.
Mr. Rozier stated he remembers seeing Dennis Perry the weekend before the murder of the Swains. Mr. Rozier advised he knew Perry because his daughter went to school with him. Mr. Rozier said he lived next door to Zeke Wilson, who is Perry's grandfather. Mr. Rozier advised he remembered seeing a brown Plymouth Duster, which Perry drove, at Wilson's residence on the Saturday before the shooting occurred. Mr. Rozier advised about 3 months after the murder occurred, Robert Massey told him about an argument that took place between one of Mac Williams' sons and Harold Swain. Mr. Rozier said Perry was present during the argument. Mr. Rozier explained the argument was over one of Williams' boys growing marijuana on Harold Swain's property. Swain told the Williams boys to get the dope off his property or he would call the police. Ms. Rozier stated she saw Perry up and down the road the whole weekend before the shooting. Ms. Rozier said she saw Dennis driving a tan Plymouth Duster.
There are some big problems here with Corky Rozier's story. First, this brown Duster that Dennis Perry was supposedly driving around in, it doesn't exist. Not in reality, and also not as a matter of the prosecution's theory of the case. Because neither Dennis Perry nor his grandparents owned a Duster. The GBI had tried to confirm that they actually had one, like Rozier had said, and they couldn't. Besides, Dennis Perry having his own car is actually bad news for the state's case. Because according to the state, Dennis Perry had a ride down to Waverly on the back of a motorcycle, and had to walk to Rising Daughter to get there. Neither of which are things that someone with a car would have done, probably.
And second, there's also the problem that Corky Rozier's 1998 story was just a rehashing of his original Unsolved Mysteries tip. It's just another variation of the same rumor about everyone in Waverly has heard at this point, about how Harold Swain was killed because he discovered a marijuana field. But Dennis Perry wasn't friends with Mac Williams' sons, and there's nothing I've seen outside of Corky Rozier's claims about Mac Williams' sons having a secret marijuana field in the Swains' property. It doesn't seem as if Dale Bundy had believed Corky's story either, because there's no evidence he even tried to interview Robert Massey or Mac Williams' sons to try and verify it. Butch Kennedy recalled that back in the 1980s, when he was working on the case, he'd interviewed Corky too, after he'd called in a tip about Dennis Perry to Unsolved Mysteries. Even though there's no record of this interview now, Kennedy is confident that it happened.
Maybe not reduced to writing because I didn't believe it.
But you remember talking to him about this case?
Yeah.
So the
because Corky was a shady character. I mean, he wasn't a bad guy. He was just a crook.
Prosecutor John Johnson apparently found Corky Rozier and his wife Glenda more credible. He subpoenaed both of them to testify at Dennis Perry's trial, and in his opening statement, he told the jury that they'd be hearing from both Corky and Glenda during trial. At some point during the trial, though, John Johnson changed his mind, because he never did call them to the stand. Now, it turns out that was probably a good call on John Johnson's part. When Susan had mentioned to GBI agent Joe Gregory how confused she was about what was going on with Corky Rozier and his failure to make an appearance at Dennis's trial, Gregory told her about the trap the defense had set and would have sprung if the prosecution had tried to call him.
They did not put Rozier on the stand. They, for some reason...
Oh, no, they knew better than that because Perry's attorney was waiting to pounce on him about his previous perjuries. And we had aerial photographs that was going to prove it was impossible for him to see what he claimed to see.
For a lot of reasons, then, it just really doesn't make much sense that Corky Rozier, of all people, would have been the one to get the reward money in this case. So I probably would have dismissed it all as empty talk if it wasn't for the fact that the rumors about it that Butch Kennedy had heard, well, they had come from a very specific source.
So Jane Beaver, I'm curious to find out what the money was she might have gotten, where it might have come from.
I can't be honest and tell you that actually happened.
But it's what you heard.
But I do know when I was working at the tax office, Corky's wife came in there, and she said that they used some of the money for Corky's surgery on one of his hands.
That is Ghost. She's about 16 years old and only 6 pounds. And when we adopted her last year, we thought we were getting a quiet little senior cat who would peacefully lounge on the couch all day long. Yeah, we were wrong about that. It turns out that Ghost is a demanding and energetic little terror who purrs like a jet engine and turns into Houdini whenever she wants to steal people food. For some reason, we love her anyway, and that's why we switched to Pretty Litter. Pretty Litter is K-Litter 2.0. It has next level odor protection, and it uses super absorbent crystals that actually trap and conceal odor and moisture. No smell, no mess. To make things even more convenient, Pretty Litter is mailed straight to your door in a lightweight bag that lasts the entire month. And it also does something that no other kitty litter does. It changes colors to detect underlying illnesses before urgent medical care is needed. And with an older cat like Ghost, being able to identify a potential medical issue at the earliest possible moment can make all the difference. So do what I did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and using the promo code undisclosed for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed, for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed. Corky Rozier passed away a few years ago, but his wife Glenda still lives in Woodbine, and my hope was that she might know more about why her husband had been subpoenaed by the state as a witness for Dennis's trial. After all, she'd been subpoenaed for it too. When I went to her house to talk to her, she immediately invited me in. She was very friendly and welcoming, and right away, I began to doubt that I'd be getting the whole story from her.
Do you know how your name came to be in the police file?
Maybe because we lived next door to them?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where we lived, you know, right next to them.
So the first time I know that I've seen your name in the file is from Unsolved Mysteries. Do you recall seeing a show about this case?
I'm not sure.
The curious thing about trying to interview Glenda Rozier was that she couldn't recall anything about her role in Dennis Perry's case until I'd first explained to her what about it I already knew. At which point, she too would recall the thing I just told her about. But she'd recall no more than that.
Did you know that your husband called in Dennis Perry as a tip?
Who did?
Your husband did.
He did?
Mm-hmm. That's why y'all got interviewed.
Oh, okay. Well, he probably knew something, you know, and he thought maybe that would help.
She was definitely what I'd describe as evasive. But at the same time, it didn't come across as she was trying to be completely unhelpful either. For any questions I had that were unrelated to her involvement or her husband's involvement in the case, she would try to answer. At one point, when she'd forgotten the name of someone she thought I should talk to, she called up her daughter to see if she knew the answer. Glenda's daughter, Laurie, it turned out, is a police officer up in McIntosh County. But she was off work that day, and when Laurie found out why her mother had rung her up to ask after the name of some long-ago acquaintance, she'd rushed over to her mother's house to find out what was going on.
So here's what I have. Hi.
Hey.
I'm Susan.
Laurie.
Nice to meet you. I was just showing her.
You can come sit on the
side
so you can see.
Both read it.
Now, who are you investigating for?
Laurie Rozier was clearly alarmed to find me in her mother's house. But after I introduced myself and explained why I was there, she seemed to relax. Whatever she'd been worried about, apparently I wasn't it.
We had a whole bunch of stuff go on that said that my daddy took a whole bunch of money but for some kind of reward for this. And then they went on this blog and they posted that he was crooked. My sister planted evidence. My sister was in high school. As you can see, he went to school with her. My sister mm-hmm. was not even in law enforcement at the time. So they twisted everything around that saying my daddy took this reward money. We never saw any reward money or whatever. So I don't know where they're getting this information from, but for a long time, he got blamed for a lot of stuff.
I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, but I'd be very curious to see it if you...
It's the topic thing that they used to...
Oh, it's the topics? Okay. No, I've not really. You're not the first person I've heard talk about it, but I don't know what it is, really.
Yeah, and they were saying something about that Daddy was the one that asked this lady if it was Dennis that she saw, and my daddy had nothing to do with the investigation.
As Laurie was explaining this whole backstory to me, I was left feeling like I'd walked in halfway through a conversation on something that I knew nothing about. But I could at least assure her that no, I wasn't from Topics, and no, I wasn't one of the bloggers.
Well, that's why I came down here to find out who you were, because I didn't want somebody from there coming here harassing her.
As I would later come to learn, all of this drama with the bloggers had actually taken place over a decade ago now. It had actually all begun on Topics, which is a website that provides message boards where people who live in the same local community can talk to one another online. Back in 2006 and 2007, when Dennis Perry's conviction had been a popular discussion topic there, for months on end, common threads had been full of arguments and accusations about what had really happened in the case and who was to blame. Eventually, that combat had spilled out of Topics and into warring blogspot sites. And the Rochers hadn't been the only victims of the great Camden County Topics War. Dale Bundy had been a casualty of it, too.
When we started, you mentioned something about being drugged through the ringer on something on this case. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
I've been accused of framing Dennis Perry and all that stuff from a local blogger named Rick Rogers.
Okay, so I was wondering about like court stuff, but who's this blogger?
Just some idiot that takes things that... He did everything he could to make Sheriff Smith look bad and drug me through the ringer with it. You know, I'm used to it. I got thick skin. You can't do what I do without having thick skin.
Is he a local or is he...
Yeah, he's an idiot.
After being assured, though, that it wasn't from Topics, Laurie Rocher had been more than happy to talk and share with me what she knew, which wasn't all that much. She'd been a kid when the Swains were killed and hadn't followed the trial. Mostly what she knew came from reading the online attacks against her family.
I knew that was his grandma then, right?
That's where this whole thing went crazy, is because everybody was blaming Daddy because we knew the sheriff. And just because they asked Daddy about this argument or whatever they had, everybody come back that Daddy was supposedly getting this reward money. My daddy
What reward money?
There was some kind of reward for the murders.
For turning somebody in for doing it.
There was some kind of reward for the murders.
Are you sure there was a reward?
That's what they said.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Because he got accused of taking some reward money for conviction of the murder.
But no, he didn't get no money out of nothing.
Laurie Rocher was very aware of the fact that her own feelings about Dennis Perry's case were so mixed up with her feelings about Topics and the bloggers that it was hard for her to separate the two.
I just got tired of reading it because it kept making me mad, especially since my dad's gone. So I just kind of like pushed it off.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to hold him mm-hmm. responsible or have an ill feeling towards him because of what everybody else is saying. Yeah. Because I in my job mm-hmm. that I do, I can't do that. I can't base opinions because you never know when they're innocent. You know, you're innocent until proven guilty. Well, I understand he had his trial. He's been convicted and everything, but sometimes that's not always right.
In the end, I didn't learn much about the Swain case from the Rochers, and I didn't get the answers I'd been hoping to find out. But following that first trip down to Camden County, I did come away with two new research hobbies. The first had been civil forfeiture laws, and the second was the Great Camden County Topics War of 2007. As it would turn out, those two things had a lot more in common than you might think. There are a lot of political bloggers in Camden County, or at least there were, back in around 2007, which was the time period I was interested in. There were also a lot of people who were busy having flame wars and topics over obscure matters of local county governance. Out of all of them, one of the most prolific posters was this guy named Rick Rogers. He doesn't live in Camden County anymore. Actually, Dale Bundy told me at one point that Rick Rogers had been run out of the county, and I'm still not sure if he meant it in the literal or metaphorical sense. Either way, today, Rick Rogers wants nothing to do with Camden County, or even the whole state of Georgia. But 10 years ago, he talked about Camden County a lot, and he blogged about it a lot. Like, a lot. And he had quite a few blogs. He even had one that was entirely dedicated to Dennis Perry's case, where he methodically posted copies of the available transcripts from Dennis Perry's trial. And that blog is relatively low-key in tone. But Rick had other blogs, too. And some of them are, well, less low-key. Take, for instance, the Real School Police blog. For that site's logo, Rick chose a World War II photo of soldiers crossing a trench, and superimposed on it is some text that says, "Parents declare war on school board." I think this blog started off as a place where Rick Rogers could protest certain policies that had been implemented by the Camden County School Board, but the scope quickly expanded. And for years, Rick Rogers used the site to wage a one-blogger crusade against the rampant corruption that he saw all around him in Camden County. It is not the easiest blog to read. It's got a little bit of that old-school GeoCities feel to it, and Rick Rogers is the kind of guy who posts a 30-page Word document, not as a single PDF, but as 30 individual JPEGs. And the comment pages on his blog are a straight-up mess. In part, that's because they're just fragments of a broader meta-conversation that was going on, as the blogs were really just a new battlefield for the ongoing topics war. And like on topics, while sometimes the conversations in the comments were civil, just as often they were strings of all caps text filled with vitriol and misspelled insults. To read Rick Rogers' blog is to dive into a years-long internet flame war, in which all of the usual tensions are magnified by the fact that, in this case, the people involved are all local, and anytime they leave their house or step into a grocery store, they risk running into one another. Also, everyone is constantly threatening to sue everyone else, and once in a blue moon, someone actually does it. All of which is to say, I loved everything about it. I'd gone to Rick Rogers' blogs because of what I've been told by people I'd interviewed, but I kept reading them because, well, if I'm being completely honest, gawking at a good internet train wreck is one of my favorite things. And if you like that sort of thing, well, Rick's blogs are a treasure. I know I'm not the only one who feels that way, at least, because when I talked to Mike Ellerson, the former deputy from the Camden County Sheriff's Office, he'd been just as entertained by it all as I had been.
Reading that stuff back in the day was some funny shit. It was funny. It's like, oh God, they just called out such and such such. And I get on the phone and go, hey, you reading topics? Like, what? It's like, hey, Rick Rogers and Jay, they talking about such and such. Get on there and check it out. And, you know, we on the phone talking, oh shit, you know.
The topics wars were hilarious, but also vicious. It quickly became clear to me why Dale Bundy and the Rogers had still been upset about the bloggers, even after all these years. Many of the comments about them were angry attacks on their character, their families, and these attacks were often as brutal as they were incoherent. The thing is, though, the stuff written on the Real School Police blog wasn't made up. It just lacked all sense of proportion. For Rick Rogers, it didn't seem to matter whether he discovered evidence that some Camden County employee had used a work computer to look at his blog during work hours, or if he'd submitted an open records request and had unearthed genuine evidence of a Camden County government official taking a bribe. Because he'd read about both those things with the exact same degree of urgency and alarm. They were equal scandals in his eyes, and deserving of an equal number of exclamation points. And there was no shortage of exclamation points to go around. All of that made Rick Rogers really easy to dismiss, which is sort of unfortunate because the guy was actually putting in some serious work into his role as citizen watchdog. He was submitting tons of open records requests to various government agencies in Camden County and dumping the results on his blog, usually without much in the way of context about why these documents were important, but still, the documents were there, buried deep within pages of flame wars and petty complaints, but there. Which is why, 10 years ago, when Rick Rogers found something huge in Dennis Perry's case, no one who could have done anything about it actually noticed. Because in 2007, Rick Rogers obtained records of an audit that had been done on the equitable sharing accounts of the Camden County Sheriff's Office, including bank records for those accounts from 2002 and 2003. And those records show that on April 3rd, 2003, just weeks after Dennis Perry's conviction, Jane Beaver and Corky Rozier were both paid $12,000 each out of the seized asset funds. Oh, and just to dispel any doubts that there might have been about what these payments were actually for, in the audit records, there's a helpful little note in the description line. It reads, reward. $12,000 and $12,000 is $24,000. Very close to the $25,000 that had been advertised on Prime Suspect. In other words, it looks exactly like Corky Rozier and Jane Beaver had split the reward for their help in convicting Dennis Perry. And all of this was kept secret from the defense. I asked Dan Albin from the Institute for Justice about it to see if this was something he'd encountered before.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing something like that. It's possible, it is possible that it happens. It's not immediately obvious to me that it's entirely improper in ways that go beyond paying any witness for anything.
Dan Albin was right about this. I looked more into it later, and the use of civil forfeiture funds to pay rewards or to give money to informants under the federal guidelines, at least in terms of civil forfeiture regulations, these payments to Jane Beaver and Corky Rozier were a far more appropriate use of the seized asset money than were most of the disbursements that Sheriff Smith had made from that account. But the question of whether this payment would be appropriate as a matter of federal seized asset guidelines, that's unrelated to the question of whether these payments were appropriate as a matter of due process when it comes to Dennis Perry's trial. And that Jane Beaver was expecting and had received compensation, yeah, that's unquestionably material to her credibility as a witness. And that money was paid out. When I asked Dale Bundy about it, he didn't deny that the payments had been made. He just denied having any involvement in the decision to make those payments. And when I spoke to Jane Beaver's daughter, Carol Ann, she confirmed to me that Jane Beaver had gotten the reward money. Or actually, she confirmed that Jane Beaver had gotten half the reward money. Jane Beaver, it turns out, had been pretty ticked off about that. Carol Ann told me that Jane Beaver had felt like the money should have been all hers. After all, no one else in the case had come forward with anything nearly as helpful as what Jane Beaver had. And I gotta say, I kinda agree with Jane Beaver on this one. Corky Rozier hadn't done anything I could see that would warrant splitting the reward with him. Actually, if the reward was gonna be split at all, it should have been split between Cora Fisher and Vanzella Williams. They're the ones who really earned it. They'd come forward and testified, even though they'd been scared, because they felt it was the right thing to do. Instead, this reward got split and half given to Corky Rozier. But why? And why had the Rozers denied that Corky had gotten the money?
I wonder who got a reward.
I don't know there was a reward, but if there was, I'd be curious to find out too.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out who it is that keeps saying all that stuff.
Corky's wife, Glenda, must have known exactly who'd gotten that reward. Or at least she must have known exactly who'd gotten half the reward. But I'm not convinced that Corky's daughter, Laurie, had been told about it or that she actually knew the whole story. At least in part, that's because if Laurie had had any reason to think that her mother had something to hide, I'm pretty sure she would have kicked me out of the house right away. Instead, she stayed to talk. Although, I do have some questions there too, because Laurie Rozier's name also appears in the seized asset funds. Remember those payments for tuition and textbooks? Well, in 2003 and 2005, Laurie Rozier's tuition at Valdosta State University was paid for by people who had been interdicted on I-95. But all this Corky Rozier stuff didn't make sense to me. It still doesn't. I asked Agent Gregory if he'd ever encountered something like it.
But his daughter, Laurie, why is she getting her college tuition and college textbooks paid out of the drug fund?
Hey, you want my gut feeling or what?
I mean, is that normal?
Sounds like, no, sounds like payoff to me.
There was one more person, though, who I thought would know the answer, and maybe he'd even tell it to me. That was Bill Smith himself. So I asked him, why exactly did Corky Rozier get that $12,000?
I don't remember that. We gave him money for, what was the reason that we gave him the money,
Corky? It says reward.
Was it another investigation?
It says reward in, like, the byline. So it looks like that Jane Beaver and Corky Rozier each paid $12,000 as a reward.
Bill Smith didn't seem to have any more idea than I did about why Corky Rozier had gotten that money. And his attempts to puzzle out why it might have happened seemed to have been nothing more than guesses.
Well, that was when we were trying to solve it, and we needed information, which we received from those. I didn't know Corky was involved in it. Corky Rozier was,
I think they were, I don't know what happened exactly. I know they subpoenaed him for the trial, and he was going to testify, but he never actually did for some reason, but I don't know why.
He was working at the jail there. He might have been, he might have received information that he was the individual or something. I don't know. I don't remember.
Oh, interesting.
To be honest with you.
Whatever the reason may have been, though, Bill Smith told me, in making the decision to actually pay out the reward to Jane Beaver and Corky Rozier, he would not have been acting on his own.
He went to Corky and her?
Yeah, both. I guess they each got 12. Yeah.
I don't remember, to be honest with you. I do, well, anyway. Is my name on the check or something?
No, I don't have those records. I was just wondering if you knew, like, why they were paid or why the drug funds were used or what that was about.
I think we probably talked with the district attorney at the time. Who was the DA that prosecuted the case? Do you remember that?
The prosecutor was John Johnson.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, he would have been the person that I had gotten with to get it approved.
The bank records that Rick Rogers had from the Camden County Seized Asset Fund were incomplete, and the sheriff's office no longer has copies going back that far, so a complete set can't be obtained from them now. But the records we do have, which span from 2001 to 2007, show that amid all the donations to local clubs, the payments to inmates, and the $240 lunches at Cumberland Island's prestigious Grayfield Inn, there were other disbursements beyond just the ones to Jane Beaver and Corky Rozier that may have impacted Dennis Perry's case. Because from 2001 to 2003, during the time that Dennis Perry was in jail and awaiting trial, Sheriff Bill Smith was making payments not only to the DA's office that was prosecuting Dennis Perry's case, but also to the court whose judge was presiding over it. And for those payments to the prosecutor's office, well, maybe there's a good explanation for why that was happening. And based on the limited records, it's hard to tell what exactly was going on. But most months, the sheriff's office would take a sum of money out of the seized assets fund and then divide it between the Camden County Board of Commissioners and the DA's office. The lion's share, 90% of it, would go to the board. Only 10% went to the DA. But still, just based on records for 6 months in 2000 and 2002, we're talking transfers of $40,000. That's not nothing.
There were other payments, though, that Bill Smith was making that I have a harder time trying to rationalize away. Like the payments that were made to the Glenn County Drug Court. Because that's the court that Judge Amanda Williams, the judge in Dennis Perry's case, had presided over. At the time, the drug court was relatively new, just a few years old, but it was very much Judge Williams' pet project. And to continue to operate, it needed funding. It turns out that a significant portion of that funding was coming from Bill Smith. Or at least from Bill Smith through the seized asset accounts.
Mm-hmm. And it's making like $100,000 donations to the court that is hearing its cases.
Oh, so that would be, so if it were to say the local health department or something.
No, this is to the court that's hearing the cases.
That actually raises really fundamental due process problems because as much as police and prosecutors are supposed to not be biased, we all know that they are to some extent. You can't help but be when your job is to catch criminals and prosecute them. You have a bias towards doing that. And similarly, you have a bias towards seizing assets when you get some of the proceeds from those assets. But the courts themselves are not even supposed to have an appearance of bias. There's not supposed to be an appearance of impropriety.
In 2001 and 2003, there were two donations that Bill Smith made from the Seized Asset Fund to Judge Williams' drug court. The first donation was for $50,000, and it was made on August 7th, 2001, the day before a critical pretrial hearing in Dennis Perry's case, where the judge would end up ruling against Dennis Perry's motions to exclude the eyewitness identifications of Vanzola Williams and Cora Fisher. And the second donation, also for $50,000, was made on May 21st, 2003, just 2 months after Dennis Perry's trial, and while his motion for a new trial was still pending before Judge Williams. There's no way to know for sure here if or how Judge Williams' decisions in Dennis Perry's case could have been influenced by those payments from Sheriff Smith to the drug court, but that's the whole reason that even the appearance of impropriety is so problematic in this context.
I mean, What you're telling me now makes me want to pick up the phone and call someone at DOJ and have them, like someone in the anti-corruption side, not someone related to anything to do with asset forfeiture, but just because DOJ investigates corruption. That sounds like blatant corruption. I mean, it's not just something that violates due process and that lawyers would go, that's a real concern. That sounds like something that is at least an attempt to influence a judge in an active proceeding.
There's no need now, though, for Dan Albin to make any calls, because 7 years ago, someone else already did. Not in connection with Dennis Perry's case, but in connection with some other cases before the same judge, in which her impartiality had been called into question. That call wasn't made to the DOJ, but instead to the JQC. That's Georgia's Judicial Qualification Commission. And as a result of that, the JQC opened a wide-ranging investigation into what exactly was going on in the courtroom of Judge Amanda Williams. Next time on Undisclosed. Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. We'll be back on Thursday with an addendum episode, so send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. Mithal Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crime Runners On podcast. You can find case-related materials, timelines of key events, and witness charts on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. Transcripts of this episode and past episodes are available on our website and are prepared by our transcribing team, Retta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logos, and Skylar Park. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all our social media accounts, our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.